It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, an influential game designer tells us how she and other women got their starts in the technology industry on a virtual pet website. First, it's open enrollment season for Americans who want to sign up for the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. It's also the first time people are signing up for a health care plan that the White House is actively trying to end. Right now, there are more people enrolling in Obamacare than there were at the same time last year, but some local government officials in Wisconsin are worried that the overall enrollment number could go down. Phil Rocco is an assistant professor of political science at Marquette University. He's also co-author of the book Obamacare Wars. He joins us now to take a closer look at these enrollment numbers. Phil, welcome back to the show.
Great to be here.
Well, where are we on Affordable Care Act coverage enrollment here in the state right now?
Well, in Wisconsin, enrollment, if we're comparing this year to last year, enrollment at this period for week three, which is the last week that we have data for, enrollment is actually up 34%, kind of surprisingly, from last year.
But this is going to be a shorter enrollment period. So even though it's pacing ahead of last year, it could end up, we don't know where it's going to end up.
That's right. The overall statistics are good for this point in open enrollment, but there are some worries, some pretty well-founded worries, that when we begin to look at the entire enrollment period, which is 6 weeks shorter, it's half as long as it was in the past, that is going to really cut off or place a cap on what enrollment is going to be.
There's been a concern of people who are trying to get people to sign up that the word isn't out there. There aren't as many outreach efforts as there have been in the past. What is the difference there?
Well, yeah, nearly a third of people who don't have health insurance reported in a study that was published last week that they had not heard anything about the sign-up period for open enrollment this year. And that's really, really surprising. But it's less surprising if you consider that there's been some pretty specific moves by the administration to really reduce the amount of information that's out there about open enrollment. So funding for actually in-person assisters, people who help other people enroll, was cut by 40%. The department just let the budget run out. And the administration also pulled out of doing a lot of the events that are supposed to generate interest in open enrollment. The budget for advertising for the exchanges, which is really how people find out about the fact that there is an open enrollment period and that they can sign up, that budget was cut by 90%, from $100 million to $10 million. So in terms of outreach, there's been a lot of changes in policy by the administration that have made it a lot harder for people to understand that this is an open enrollment period, it's going to be 6 weeks, and here's where you can sign up.
Of course, there is the ongoing effort to change or end the Affordable Care Act. The latest version would be in the Senate tax plan, which would end the individual mandate. Does this kind of uncertainty affect enrollment?
Yeah, I think that when you look at why is the individual mandate, which is, of course, it's not a popular part of the law, but one of the reasons the individual mandate is there is to generate lower premiums by broadening the risk pool. If the individual mandate is removed, it has one effect on open enrollment this time, which is people begin to think that they don't have to enroll. The incentive isn't there, even though in the tax bill it actually won't take effect for another year. So technically, people, even if the individual mandate is repealed, people will still have to enroll this time. But the administration has actually sent a variety of sort of mixed signals about whether or not it's going to enforce the individual mandate. Of course, it's still on the books. It's still law. You still have to sign up for coverage if you don't have a qualified health plan. But that's created some uncertainty for people in the exchanges about whether or not they're actually going to have to pay the penalty. And that might also lower enrollment from past years.
Phil Rocco is with us from Marquette University. We're looking at the Affordable Care Act. The enrollment period is on now and for another couple of weeks. Phil, one part of the story I haven't asked about yet, premiums. What has happened to premiums for Wisconsinites who are going to sign up here?
Yeah, so one of the major changes from this year from last year to this year is that the Trump administration has stopped making federal payments to health insurers kind of just days before open enrollment began. And this didn't affect things for all plans, but it drove up premiums in some cases by as much as 30% for some plans. And in general, this kind of uncertainty for insurers has led some insurers, if you think about in southeastern Wisconsin, where I am here in Milwaukee, it's caused insurers like Molina to leave the market. And that doesn't affect premiums for everybody, right? 83% of Wisconsinites that are signing up for ACA coverage on the marketplace are going to get federal subsidies to offset those premiums, right? So, the people who don't qualify for that tax credit, and that means, you're a person making $50,000 a year, they're going to be paying full price. And outreach and, what people know about whether or not they can enroll and where to enroll and how to do it matters. But another reason that people might not sign up for coverage is they don't think it's a good value or that the premiums are too high. And that has really been affected by the policies that the Trump administration has put in place.
We've heard some concern from local officials in Milwaukee and elsewhere that not enough people will sign up for the Affordable Care Act. Why would that be something that would be worrisome on a local level?
Well, I think on a local level, when people don't have health insurance coverage, sometimes they will have to go to the emergency room to get the care they need. They will be in cases of people who have behavioral health problems or mental health problems, they might ultimately end up in the justice system, and so just because people aren't enrolling in the system, it doesn't mean they go away. They and their health problems that they might experience, we might have to bear the cost of those problems as a society in other ways.
And getting back to the individual mandate, if—and this is a big if—if it ends up being repealed in this tax care overhaul effort, what does that do to Wisconsin when it comes to the Affordable Care Act?
Well, if the individual mandate is repealed, it's quite likely that we're going to see major spikes in the number of people who don't have health insurance coverage. It's quite possible that premiums will go up and that fewer insurers will be on the marketplace. And so it might be the case that if the individual mandate is repealed, the individual marketplace that we have here in Wisconsin becomes destabilized, and there might be a greater pressure for the state to make some policy changes that help people cope with that change.
And can you talk about, you've written about how states responded to the Obamacare mandates and changes. What particular things did we do here in Wisconsin that are part of this enrollment story today?
Well, I think we can think about how state governments responded to the creation of the Affordable Care Act. Wisconsin was one of a number of states that did not opt to create its own health insurance exchange. And so, as a result of that, the kind of coverage and the way that people receive it is really dependent on the federal government. Wisconsin, like a lot of states governed by Republicans in the years after the law was passed, said, no way, we don't want to create a health insurance exchange. And so really a lot of the work that's gone into facilitating things like open enrollment has happened as a result of community-based organizations in cities like Milwaukee, community groups, churches, other kinds of volunteer organizations that have really sort of gotten the word out, and people who have really committed their lives to volunteering have helped people understand these pretty complicated decisions about health insurance.
Briefly, as we wrap up, we haven't gotten into the companies. You mentioned a couple of insurers have left the markets covering in Wisconsin. Some have entered the market, though. Isn't that right?
That's right. I think Quartz is one of the new companies that's in the insurance market. So there's been some fluctuation. Some companies have left. Other companies have entered. But overall, the sort of uncertainty, you can see that kind of uncertainty about the payments that are going to be made by the federal government, the kind of stability of the program, has created difficulties for companies that that want to participate in exchanges.
We'll leave it there for now, Phil. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much.
We've been talking to Phil Rocco. He's an assistant professor of political science at Marquette University, also co-author of the book Obamacare Wars. He joined us to look at the enrollment rates for the Affordable Care Act here in Wisconsin, as there are just a couple weeks left now until the end of the enrollment period. First, the technology and gaming industry has been criticized over the years for how it represents and treats and hires or doesn't hire women. In 2014, the Gamergate controversy showed the general public how hostile things can get for women who make games and play them. But there are women gamers and programmers who have thrived in the industry and made their mark on it. A lot of them have a common origin story. They were part of the fantasy pet website Neopets as girls. The site was really popular in the 2000s, and it may have served as a gateway for girls to carve out their own positive space on the internet. Nina Freeman was part of the Neopets digital universe. Now she's a programmer and game designer at the independent video game company Fulbright. She was named an influential video game figure by Forbes. Our producer, Halima Shah, talked to her about how Neopets influenced her and other women in the industry.
So Neopets seems like a really important part of this story. It was a website that took place in the virtual world of Neopia. Your main objective was to take care of virtual animals, which were Neopets. What significance at the time did this game hold for its users, especially for girls?
So for me, as someone who was already pretty involved with like making fandom websites and stuff, Neopets was a space where you had these guilds, which were spaces where you could like kind of customize your page that I think people could like join up with you as a group, sort of like a web ring or a fan listing or something. And I think it kind of brought a lot of young women together who were into like customizing their pages, almost like LiveJournal, but in these guild forums. And I remember finding a lot of like graphic sites run by teen girls my age at the time that were like, we'll make like your header image with whatever movie art you want, or like they would have like these free templates where it was like, you know, a photoshopped Pokemon image as the header and like a funny tiled background with Pokeballs on it or whatever, and they would be like, oh, you can download this and use it on your guild, and there was like whole communities around stuff like that. So I think Neopets really brought a lot of teen girls together because of that, like, interest in, you know, customizing these guilds and also just, like, playing all the fun mini games on the Neopets site and being just in general, like, a pretty, like, positive and fun and cute space where, like, you know, people of that age group could kind of come together and hang out. And it was a good place to, like, you know, get your feet wet making these guild layouts and stuff. And I know a lot of girls went on to, like, make their own websites after that, but Neopets was, like, I think, a good starting point for a lot of people.
That was foundational, not just for you, but it seems like for other people, too. I even crowdsourced this on Facebook. I posted it on Facebook and asked my friends, like, how big of a deal was this to you? And I'm not kidding. I think that's one of my posts that got the most engagement. And
really? That's awesome.
It was crazy. And I think so many people share these stories like, well, it taught me how to code. I learned about saving money and things like that. What groundwork did it lay for people who kind of eventually made their way into the tech business or into the digital sphere?
Yeah, it's cool to have been able, like, you know, sometimes we'll be chatting with other people my age and we'll be like, oh, how did we get into all this stuff? And a lot of it really did, you know, for many people start with having access to the internet during childhood and just having access to games and being passionate about them from a young age and just kind of having that there as like a sort of knowledge that you come with into adulthood and are like, oh, this is something that kind of, I think, culturally often is thought of as for kids, like for games, for example, but, you know, they're adults who make them, and they're not all for kids. Like, they can be more artistic, or they can be more like an e-sport, or they can be more like this. And I think that as this generation that grew up on the internet gets older, like, I think we'll see more interesting games and more interesting tech stuff, just because we've been so immersed in it since a young age that I think, you know, a lot of people of that generation think about it in a really interesting way.
And you have a game that really looks back at this time, too. You've created LostMemories.net, which is about teen girls on the internet and blogging in 2004. Why did you want to make a game about that experience?
So I made it for the Manchester International Festival, which is a big commissioned art festival. And for them, yeah, I pitched for this idea originally. I was like, oh, I really want to make a game about, like, I remember being in chat rooms as a tween, like, literally going into AOL chat rooms with, like, total strangers and just, like, chatting with them because I was curious. I just remembered this one actual online friend, like, my first online friend I ever made, and I met her through, like, fandom website making. I remember she had an amazing Sailor Moon fan site. and her and I chatted a lot on AIM, and I would, like, kind of tell her about my school life and what boys I liked and, like, what my drama was. So, yeah, I wanted to make a period piece really focusing in on my relationship with her and what it was like and what it was like making websites back then. That was a really special moment in my life, I think.
I think that when we talk about the internet in the 2000s, and especially Neopets, it feels a little nostalgic. It almost feels a little bit idyllic.
Yeah.
You know, it was before Gamergate. It was before this time when the general public became so conscious of the death and the rape threats and the intimidation that women can face on the internet. Was the internet a less complicated place back then, or did we just not know better?
Yeah, when I was doing, like, the fandom website stuff, you know, I was mostly just making friends, and it was all, like, very positive. And I was so young that I didn't really have any, you know, context for kind of the negative stuff. But when I was around the same age, I started playing Final Fantasy Online, and definitely, you know, ran into, at that age, like, boys in that online game being like, you can't be a girl, or, like, girls don't play games, what are you doing? So that kind of stuff was definitely already happening. I think maybe I ran into it less on, like, Neopets and fandom sites because it was more dominated by younger women, or, like, maybe boys who weren't really thinking like that yet or who hopefully never started thinking like that. And it was, I think, probably less talked about because there wasn't as much of, like, a Twitter or something where information can just be disseminated so quickly.
I'm talking to Nina Freeman. She's a programmer and game designer, and we're looking at girls and women in the digital gaming industry. And it's really interesting to hear you talk about gaming as an art form, because I think right now, a lot of times when you look at the news and you hear people talk about gaming, a lot of times it's the anxieties of parents who are trying to figure out how much screen time should I let my kid have and how much time should I allow them to spend on the internet. Is this ultimately a good or a bad force? How do you think about gaming as a person who makes them? Is it really that simple of a good or bad question, or is there more to it?
I guess in the broadest sense, obviously everything in moderation, but also I think we do have a weird cultural stigma around video games, which at times can be deserved. Like, you know, there's a lot of violence in games, and, like, there's also violence in movies and violence in TV, and often it's worse than a lot of video games. But I think a lot of people are kind of scared off by the interactive aspect. But I still think, like, games can be so great for helping people really, like, get into a mindset and show them something by doing. You know, like, a lot of people really learn well by, like, doing something rather than just being told it. I think games are really good for that kind of thing. So I think ultimately, like, I really think games are positive in general. It's just there's so many different kinds of games that it's, like, you do need to kind of curate what you actually want out of games.
What would you like to see happen to make gaming culture maybe more accessible to people, maybe if they haven't always been immersed in that scene?
Yeah, I think about this because, like, It's funny because I came into the games industry without a lot of experience playing some of the more like classic or more popular games. I really have always been more into like some pretty niche stuff. So I know how it feels. And I know at Fulbright, which is the studio I work at out here in Oregon, like we talk a lot about how we want our games to be accessible to a lot of different people because you can really do that through design. Like I think many games are designed with expectations that the player knows a lot about like how the game should be played, what the controls are ahead of time, because they're assuming that that person has played many video games before, which is often the case because of that kind of thing, I think. So I think it's good, and I think it's happening more and more that like studios like us are thinking more about like players who don't have those assumptions about like how, for example, like a first-person shooter controls, and that like we really want to make games that have more mechanics that really you can pick up without any assumptions about what's going on. I think we're interested in making more human-oriented games like that that don't have a bunch of assumptions about what the player knows coming in. And I think that can be a good way for designers and developers to make games that are more accessible to new people who haven't played much of this stuff before.
Nina, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you.
That was Nina Freeman talking to producer Halima Shah about how women and girls carved out their own space in gaming culture and the technology industry. Nina's a programmer and game designer at Fulbright, an independent video game company. First, Wisconsin's juvenile justice system has been controversial in recent years. The state's youth prisons, the Lincoln Hills School for Boys and Copper Lake School for Girls, have been the subject of reports of abuse and misconduct by inmates and staff, as well as unsafe working conditions for staff. Now, the system is under increased scrutiny, and experts and lawmakers are looking at ways to change it. That includes looking at other states around the country as potential models for a better juvenile justice system. Molly Beck covers politics and state government for the Wisconsin State Journal. She's been following the uncertain future of the state's youth prisons. Molly, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, there are a lot of different thoughts about what could change, but do you get the sense, talking to different stakeholders, that people want some kind of change, whatever that might be?
Sure. The lawmakers I've talked to, they've all agreed that they're not supportive of what's going on currently, whether that's the model of juvenile incarceration in Wisconsin's fault or, you know, the staffing issues at Lincoln Hills or, you know, a number of other reasons that there are so many issues that people hear about at the youth prison there in Irma. But I think a prevailing idea when I talk to everybody who's kind of engaged in this conversation is a regional facility closer to Milwaukee might make sense if they can figure out how to do that. One concern that some lawmakers brought up at the time that the state consolidated its youth prisons and sent all of its serious juvenile offenders to the Northwoods campus there was that, you know, a lot of these kids were coming from the Milwaukee area and they were going to be now about 4 hours away from home. And a lot of juvenile justice experts say that that's not going to, you know, help those kids rehabilitate.
And I understand some lawmakers and others are looking at other states for inspiration, and Missouri is one state mm-hmm. that's come up. What is different there? What do they do in Missouri?
Right. Yeah. So Missouri is kind of considered to be a sort of standard of juvenile incarceration, and a big reason is because they don't have these big, you know, several hundred inmate facilities like Wisconsin has, for example. What they have are 32 small facilities that generally don't have any more than 20 or 30 inmates. And for the most serious inmates, that would be comparable to the kind of inmates that are at Lincoln Hills. I think it's about 10. And so it's a very small facility. It's probably more staff per inmate than the larger facilities. And for the less serious juvenile offenders, the facilities resemble more like a college or a small school or something. I don't think you would identify it as a prison if you looked at them.
It sounds like a big path to get from where we are now to something like that. And what would be involved in making a change like that?
Right. There would have to be a lot. The law would have to be changed. There's currently a state law that requires a juvenile prison to be in the area that it is right now. So they would have to change the law. They would probably have to Milwaukee County, if they wanted to, you know, bring some of those kids home closer to home, they would need to find a way to fund it. I talked to Milwaukee County Executive Chris Abley, and he said, well, that's his goal, to find a way to have, you know, the serious juvenile offenders closer to Milwaukee. There's no funding for it currently, and the way state law is set up, they, you know, the most serious juvenile offenders have to be in the state's care, basically. So a number of laws would have to change. I think funding is a major issue. And there's also this, you know, federal investigation that's kind of looming over all of this that might, you know, force changes or prevent changes from happening it still goes along.
We had this dramatic moment a couple of years back, Molly, where the state's Department of Justice raided this Department of Corrections facility over all these complaints and accusations of abuse, things like that. What are we hearing now from the Department of Corrections, now under new management, about what has changed since then at Lincoln Hills?
So, yeah, 2 years ago there was a raid of investigators, and that followed about a year of investigation into allegations of abuse and all sorts of potential crimes there. And since then, I think about every person who's, you know, been in charge of the Division of Juvenile Corrections has been removed or resigned or retired. And, you know, the new secretary has, you know, changed the way staffing patterns. He has changed the way medication is distributed. He's changed, you know, the kinds of staff members that are dealing with the inmates there. I think they have a much more complicated process to review, you know, any staff injuries or inmate injuries. It sounds like, you know, they're attempting to have a lot more scrutiny of what's going on there. But they're also dealing with a lot of staffing shortages. So that's been a big hurdle for them to kind of carry out what they want to do there, because they can't keep, you know, the place fully staffed.
Molly, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Molly Beck, reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal, where she covers politics and state government. We continue our conversation about juvenile corrections in Wisconsin. Jeffrey Roman joins us now. He works for the Public Policy Institute as the benchmark coordinator for the Milwaukee Brighter Futures Initiative. He's also an organizer for Youth Justice Milwaukee. In his work, he advocates for better outcomes in the criminal justice system and other areas. Jeffrey, thanks for joining us again.
Thanks for having me again.
Well, we heard about efforts to change Lincoln Hills there and a possible road to the future. You've been calling for shutting the place down and coming up with a new system. Why are you calling for an end to what we have now?
Yeah, so I think in terms of Youth Justice Milwaukee, our stance is that there's no reforming Lincoln Hills and Copper Lakes. It cannot be reformed given the investigations that are going, given the almost daily now, if certainly weekly, things that we're hearing from the facilities. It's in no shape to be reformed. It has to be shut down, and our system has to be reimagined and revisioned. And Molly, you know, lifted up some of the key points that we're saying: closer to the home, more accessible to family and community resources, smaller, more therapeutic settings that aren't as institutionalized, but offer the supports that young people need, depending on their risk factors, so that they can actually rehabilitate and eventually reenter to the society.
Now, a case that's been made for the kids being sent to Lincoln Hills, these are offenders who maybe are too far gone in a way. They're too potentially violent to be treated at a smaller scale facility to be subject to rehabilitation. What do you say to those concerns?
Well, so there are a number of ways to look at that, and even things that we know that first and foremost, the number of young people that are being sent to Lincoln Hills and Copper Lakes, many of them don't reach the threshold, the risk factor where they have to be behind a secure setting. Certainly for those who do need to be behind there, who need secure placement, there needs to be facilities for those young people to be able to get the resources and supports that they need. However, again, those need to be closer to home, accessible to family and community supports. I mean, again, more smaller residential. It shouldn't be 40, 50, 60, 100 plus young people. It should be 15 to 20, at most 25 young people that are with a very, very close staff to young person ratio that are providing them the real needs, the real supports that they need.
Let's talk about that close to home issue. We've got the state's most populated county, of course, Milwaukee County, over there in southeastern Wisconsin, in this facility hours north of there. Why is that an important factor here, that distance?
I think the distance just underscores, you know, the way that our system is broken. We know, and the research tells us, that having young people who need to be in secure placements or you know, behind bars or locked away for whatever reasons, the chances of them rehabilitating more are higher if they have access to their community and supports from their community and their family members. And you're right, Milwaukee incarcerates the most young people. Sending them for 3, 4, 5 hours away isn't good on the young people. It's definitely not good on their families, who are needed, or a crucial part of their rehabilitation. So that's the issue, first and foremost, is that if we really want our young people to get the supports they need to be able to have access to the family and the community supports in the communities that they're ultimately going to be returning back to.
It could be a tall order, changing from what we have now, these correctional facilities up north, to more and smaller and closer to Milwaukee institutions. Expensive, logistically difficult. Is this something that the state can really tackle?
I believe so, and it's an all-hands-on-deck kind of approach. We know that the majority of the dollars that send young people from Milwaukee to the state, those dollars come from Milwaukee County residents through our tax dollars. That's about $100,000 a year per young person that's there, that's coming from Milwaukee County. And so we were a bit smarter on how we use those dollars, and we actually invested those dollars in the resources that exist here in our communities, because they do exist here in our communities, and scaling those programs, we will be able to have the spaces and the supports that we need for those young people.
Jeffrey Roman is with us. He works for the Public Policy Institute. We're talking about models for juvenile justice reform here in Wisconsin, and you can join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Is this part of your story or your family's story? Have you been affected by incarceration and the juvenile justice system, or worked in that system? Tell us what you think about this issue. And for anyone, how would you like to see Wisconsin treat young offenders, youth who have committed crimes, maybe serious crimes? Where do you think these facilities should be located in the state? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Right now, we're picking up the conversation with Jeffrey Roman of the Public Policy Institute. He's also an organizer for Youth Justice Milwaukee. We're talking about efforts to change the juvenile justice system in Wisconsin. You can share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. If you work in criminal justice, or you've been affected, or your family has been affected by incarceration, we'd love to hear from you. Do you want to see reform in Wisconsin's youth justice system? How should the state approach young people who have committed serious crimes? What changes do you want to see at Lincoln Hills? Do you want to see it closed and replaced by something else? If so, what? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go to our callers. Tom is on the line in Menominee Falls. Tom, hi.
Hi. I would like to see that Lincoln Hills would be staffed properly and the people trained that are going to work there, so they don't have to put up with the abuse and everything. And I'm getting a little tired of people saying they have to be close to their families when their families didn't take care of them in the first place, and they're the main problems. That taxpayer money is going to waste. Let's knock this nonsense off and get it staffed properly and educated properly, the workers.
Tom, thanks for the call. He's saying fix Lincoln Hills. No reason to get kids closer to their families. The families, he says, part of the problem, Jeffrey.
Well, the research refutes that. The research says that families that have access to their families and connections to their community, that they're also going to come back. They recidivate less, and they have higher chances of rehabilitation.
Tom, thanks for the call. We'll go next to James on the line in Milwaukee. James, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I attended Ethan Allen back when I was a juvenile. I went to a voluntary boot camp that was located up in Camp Douglas. It was on a military base. The boot camp, I think, it, you know, it's voluntary for one. You earn your early release or whatever, but it taught the cadets how to hold themselves accountable for their actions. And it also had like a community-based part of the program. You know, it got the kids out, learn different things. Kids that were able to earn their HSC went and worked on the military base during the day and stuff like that. And I think they need to bring the boot camp back, or programs like that or whatever, to the drill instructors that were there, you know, it taught everybody to work as a team and also learn the kids how to hold themselves accountable.
Gotcha. James, thanks for that call. He mentioned being at Ethan Allen, the now closed facility, which was closer to Milwaukee, and then alternatives to that kind of program, and in this case, a boot camp. Jeffrey, your thoughts?
Yeah, so we know that there are examples that work. For example, the Grow Academy here in Wisconsin is a model here. It's a smaller facility that it's a little bit closer to some of the communities, particularly Milwaukee, and that's a specialized workforce development of, you know, urban agriculture type of a residential kind of setting for young people who need to be in a secure setting that has supports for resources. And so whether it's boot camp or a smaller kind of specialized setting, we agree that those are models that are effective and that they work.
James, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Gil on the line in Madison. Gil, hi.
Hi. So earlier in the program, the Missouri model was discussed, and there's actually a bill that's not been able to make it out of being introduced into a committee. It's in a committee, but it's not being considered, that would call for a study of the Missouri model with the goal of having the state figuring out how they could adopt the Missouri model. It was proposed by Evan Goyke from Milwaukee, who's been working hard on these issues for a long time. I just wondered if your guest knew about that and what he might say about the prospects of that being a step towards changing things.
Gil, thanks for the call. Jeffrey, the Missouri model and efforts in the state legislature here.
Yeah, so the model in Missouri we think is a good starting point, definitely for discussion at the state level, and are thankful to the legislators who have had the insight and the will to be able to advance some of the options that do exist looking at other states and urban areas that's doing this work. It's a good model, a good starting point, but, you know, we think that it's only the starting point, that there are actual better models that could come from doing a real investigation into what the actual models that do exist, starting with the Missouri model.
Thanks for that call, Gil, at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Jeffrey Roman with the Public Policy Institute and Youth Justice Milwaukee, looking at efforts to change the juvenile justice system here in Wisconsin. There have been years of problems at the Lincoln Hills Correctional Facility, people looking to change that in various ways. So, Jeffrey, you mentioned other models apart from Missouri. Can you talk more about what kind of models you see out there proposed or in place around the country that work better than what we have here?
Yeah, and so there are getting some feedback. There are a number of models that do exist. We look at there's some models in Pennsylvania where there are actually residential treatment centers and smaller kind of residential homes that exist. There is a model in, I believe, Boston, Massachusetts called ROCA, R-O-C-C-A, that works with young people before and after they've been incarcerated, and as alternatives to incarceration, where they're working with them and they actually provide not only the residential kind of supports that they need, but also provide the specialized kind of workforce development and education things as a part of their rehabilitation. And so those are the type of models that we're looking at, and as we are doing our research and being diligent and being able to lift up the models that have been found effective in other parts of the country. And again, are appreciative of the legislators and those at the state and at the local level who are doing the same with us and working with us to identify and advance the legislation needed to be able to make those happen.
And Jeffrey, we're talking about, you know, how the state or counties deal with youth who have committed serious crimes. How about efforts that would take place before that, maybe between a minor offense and that serious crime, or maybe even before the first offense, to prevent this being a problem in the first place?
Yeah, so we believe that there are organizations and resources that exist that, if scaled, and if we were, if we were to use the dollars that we spend on incarcerating just one child a year, one young person, and reinvesting those dollars to scale those organizations and those resources and programs that do work, we would be able to provide the resources that young people, based on the risk factor that they're at, whether those are in the prevention end, whether those are for low to moderate risk young people who just need, you know, additional case management or kind of crisis support. Ultimately is what it is. Intensive monitoring, those kind of things. There are resources that do exist. Some of them are here in our backyards. They're happening very, very small scale. Others are happening at a larger scale in other communities and other states. But they do exist. And if we can be more creative and more intentional about how we use the dollars that we ultimately have control of for our young people, we will be better effective in improving outcomes in the juvenile justice system.
Now, a recent editorial in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel agreed with a lot of what you're saying, but also said, hey, for some of the more serious but still nonviolent crimes, car theft, right now young people aren't being held accountable enough. The punishments aren't strict enough. What would you say to that?
I would say that depends on how you look at the situation and who we're talking about. We make the assumption that for every young person that makes that type of mistake, that the conditions and the factors that have led to them doing that are all the same in our unison, and they're not. However, given what is happening in our communities, again, and I'll continue to drive this point, there are organizations and individuals and resources that exist that are helping those young people, that are meeting them where they are and that are providing for them and making sure that they don't following those in that path again. And again, if we are reinvesting dollars to be able to support those things that we know are effective at work, we can begin to be able to address those. To say that we're not doing enough, there's always more to do, but we are doing some things, and again, we have to be able to support those things and scale those things that have been found effective to be able to address the issues that we have in our community.
Let's go back to our callers now. Jake is with us in Waukesha. Jake, hi.
Hi, how's it going? I was wondering if the speaker has heard of Ross Green and his work in Maine.
Is that something you're familiar with, Jeffrey?
I'm sorry, what was that in May?
Ross Green in Maine? What is? Just give us a nutshell version, Jake. What's going on?
Well, he's got some really good books. I'm a special education teacher, so I reference his work when it comes to working with students with emotional behavioral disabilities, but he's working on reforming the juvenile delinquent system in Maine. He's got some really kind of neat ideas on how to do that and doing it in a caring way and in an effective way.
Jake, thanks for that call. Jeffrey, can you talk about treatment for emotional and behavior issues that Jake had referenced there?
Yeah, so I'm not familiar specifically with the model that he's referencing and the author of the book that he's referencing, but we do know that there are more therapeutic options and models that are available. We are really familiar and really excited about the cognitive behavioral therapy programs that exist here in Milwaukee and across the state. The more trauma-informed care and trauma-informed work that's happening here in Milwaukee and Milwaukee County and across the state as well. And we've had some success in getting some of our leaders and legislators at the state to actually look into those different models, particularly around the cognitive behavioral therapy and the resources, mental health and behavioral health resources that are needed for young people and their families.
Thanks a lot for that call, Jake. Briefly, as we wrap up, Jeffrey, are you optimistic that things are going to change for the better?
You know, I don't want to say that I'm not optimistic. I'm optimistic in that we have young people who have been incarcerated and their families of young people and parents of young people who are and who have been and are currently incarcerated. We have advocates, local and national, that are working with us, who are working with us to be able to become advocates and are learning the way, learning how to have conversations with their legislators and county and state leaders around this issue. So I'm hopeful in the sense that we're mobilizing our community and we're giving them the skills and the tools and the resources to be better advocates for themselves, their young people.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to Jeffrey Roman with the Public Policy Institute and Youth Justice Milwaukee talking about youth justice reform here in the state. It was 50 years ago this week that American audiences got their first listen to the new Beatles album, Magical Mystery Tour. The album was a soundtrack to the Beatles movie of the same name released in the U.S. a while later. We're going to talk about that album and the Beatles this Friday on the show, and we'll play some of the tracks from Magical Mystery Tour between now and then. And we want to hear from you. Is this a favorite album of yours? Did you grow up with the Beatles or with your parents' Beatles albums? Or have you just started to check them out 5 decades later? And what is your favorite Beatles album, Mystery Tour or otherwise? We heard from Jan on the Central Time Facebook page. Jan says the favorite albums by the Beatles, White Album, Sgt. Pepper's, and Abbey Road. Also strong contenders there for sure. Well, let us know what you think and your favorites over on the Central Time Facebook page. You can email ideas@WPR.org, or you can tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll share some of your responses coming up on Friday. This is Central Time.